You can't buy a steel there, but you can buy one at my store, CTE Outdoor Power on Perry Hill Road.
Man, I bet they cost a fortune.
Shoot. This month, Larry, I've got all steel equipment on sale. Blowers starting at only $139, grass trimmers for only $129, and the world-famous steel chainsaw starting at only $179.
Man, you gotta be kidding. That's about what I paid from the home store for this piece of junk. Now, what I do, though, if it breaks? You ship it off, it'll take 6 weeks.
No, look. Some steel components have a lifetime warranty, but if it does break, I got the parts and service departments on site. We support what we sell. And check this out. With our exclusive Advantage plan, we'll extend your warranty, repair it in 1 week, or provide you with a free loaner. Now, who else does that?
Get out of here. From now on, anytime I need anything having to do with lawn equipment, I'm going to come to see you at CTE Outdoor Power on Perry Hill Road.
Hey, guys. Baron Coleman for my friends at 4 Healthy Pets. 4 Healthy Pets is located on the Atlanta Highway, just up the hill from Faulkner University. 4 Healthy Pets has everything you need for your dog, cat, or other pet. They have the greatest line of foods Montgomery has to offer. Everything in the store is locally sourced or sourced right here in the United States of America, with the exception of a couple of things that are sourced in Australia or New Zealand. Everything at 4 Healthy Pets is healthy for your dog, cat, or other loved pets. They can show you how to rotate proteins to make sure your dog or cat is getting all the micronutrients it needs. Your dog or cat can get allergy tested, for example, so that you know that everything in the bag is healthy for your dog, cat, or other pet. Go buy 4 Healthy Pets. They've got on-site grooming. Amber does a great job with that. Teresa will take you by the hand and spend as much time as necessary to make sure everything is perfect for you. 4 Healthy Pets, 4HealthyPetsOnline.com. Just up the hill from Faulkner University on the Atlanta Highway. 4 Healthy Pets, 4 Healthy Pets.
Katie, where's your Jergens? My lotion? Here in the shower. In the shower? I use Wet Skin Moisturizer from Jergens. It's a lotion that works with water to instantly lock in moisture from my shower. My skin stays soft and luminous all day without a heavy, sticky feel. It's all-day moisture made simple.
Well, I did always teach you to enjoy the simple things in life. Can I borrow your Jergens Wet Skin Moisturizer?
Of course, Mom.
Jergens, let your beautiful shine.
The kitchen is the heart of your home. If you have your heart set on an upgrade, the Home Depot can help. Get 10% off custom countertops, quartz, granite, marble, and more for less. And free design services make your kitchen upgrade the start of something terrific. 10% off custom countertops now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid through September 24th. License or registration numbers held by or on behalf of Home Depot USA, Inc. are available at homedepot.com/license numbers or at the special services desk in Home Depot stores.
Rich Thomas Weather, brought to you by Wiley Sanders Truck Lines. There's been a recent increase in pay, plus a $1,000 sign-on bonus for regional and over-the-road drivers. Visit WileySanders.com.
Rich Thomas Weather.
Pretty routine summer evening forecast, even though it's getting late in the ball game. Could be an isolated thunderstorm somewhere in the area. Otherwise, it'll fade out after dark. Overnight low 71. Kind of humid tonight. Tomorrow, rain chances get a little bit better. Not just tomorrow, but Thursday, too. Scattered showers and thunderstorms. About 40% coverage both days. Highs in the upper 80s to around 90. Lows at night around 70. And decent chance for scattered showers and storms Friday as fall begins with a high around 89. From the National Weather Association Conference in Los Angeles, for Blue Water Broadcasting, this is Rich Thomas.
Alabama Wholesale Lumber, the best quality building materials in the River Region for decades. From common builds to special orders and local delivery. Call Alabama Wholesale Lumber. When news happens, you'll hear about it first. The River Region's most trusted voice. News Talk 93.1 FM WACV.
Hold on to your butt.
I'm quite surprised that a story had such an immediate and profound effect upon radio listeners.
Hooey pleases the boobs a great deal more than sense.
Woe is us! We're in a lot of trouble!
In politics, man must learn to rise above principle.
What the hell are we doing here?
We are behaving the way a superpower ought to behave.
Well, our behavior has produced some crappy results.
What we're witnessing now is the failure of the state. It is a death struggle for our republic.
Giving voice to liberty in our time.
Joey Clark.
Good evening and welcome to the program. You are listening to the Joey Clark Radio Hour. And I'm very excited for tonight's show. I have a very special guest I've been looking forward to talking to for a while. Be sure, folks, though, I am now on social media. Go and like the Joey Clark Radio Hour Facebook page so you can hear about great upcoming guests and whatever's on my mind. But without further ado, And yes, I know y'all love listening to guests, but without further ado, I want to bring in my guest. His name is Gary Chartier. He's the Associate Dean and Professor of Law and Business Ethics at La Sierra University out in California. Received his bachelor's degree there at La Sierra, his PhD at the University of Cambridge, and his JD at UCLA. Gary, how are you this evening?
Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. I really wanted to introduce folks to your particular outlook and all the study you have done. Now, of course, we only have like 50 minutes of talk time with ads, so we can't cover everything. But you're the author of many books, have received accolades across the board in your academic career. I personally have read your book, The Conscience of an Anarchist. It is a wonderful work, very straightforward. Sometimes when I read some of the older anarchist work or libertarian work, they tend to go on and on and on, and your book is this concise argument, and I love that and want to get into that a little bit later in the show. But first, I want to kind of ask you about your beginnings, how you personally became aware of politics and how you've evolved over the years.
Well, it's a great question, and definitely my evolution has been, kind of serpentine, I guess. I grew up in a home in which politics seemed to be pretty constant as a topic of conversation. My parents were Goldwater Republicans, and that probably unites me with a lot of other libertarians of my generation. I had parents who were Goldwater Republicans. I grew up reading science fiction and programming computers, and I was socially awkward. And so I was just primed, of course, to become a libertarian. But, my parents, had the cluster of views that you might expect under the circumstances in general. Though there were some surprises. They were both, pretty conservative Protestants, but because of the particular cluster of, theological views they had, and also because my dad was an MD who, regularly had to think about healthcare decisions, they both were pro-choice in an environment in which a lot of similarly conservative folks might not have been. And, they certainly had some libertarian impulses that I picked up from them, even as they also probably took some other positions that were not so libertarian. So I grew up probably embracing an attitude that involved a commitment to freedom that I'd picked up from them and radicalized it. And so sometime in my early to mid-adolescence, I started reading libertarian literature, pretty predictable stuff. I read some Milton Friedman, some Hayek, some Rothbard, some Robert Nozick, and found myself really really engaged by that. I took an unfortunate detour kind of at the end of adolescence, toward the end of college. I think I was unprepared to grapple with the probably some difficulties that the world presents to anybody. I wasn't sure how libertarianism would respond, how anarchic views would respond to various kinds of large-scale social problems and social misery, and I didn't really have a framework to grapple with that properly, and I drifted into what was in general a kind of boring and pretty conventionally social democratic view for a while. And then, as I like to say to people, what really brought me back to my libertarian roots was the 1-2 punch delivered by George W. Bush and Barack Obama, who succeeded in radicalizing me because it was just so obvious how much they were aggrandizing power, engaging in war and, bailing out their corporate cronies and so forth. And it was impossible to continue being at all sanguine about state power. And at the same time, thanks to the joys of the Internet, I rediscovered the libertarian world and was able to really connect with some great people, notably folks like Sheldon Richmond and Charles Johnson, Roderick Long, Kevin Carson, Joe Stromberg, and some others, really gave me some intellectual tools that I could use to on the one hand, recover and celebrate and deepen and intensify that earlier libertarianism and the anarchist impulses that I've been embracing from early on, and at the same time, you know, understand and deal with some of the you know, the social problems that I'd been concerned about and hadn't been able to kind of fit within a libertarian framework conveniently. So, yeah, it was a kind of, you know, maybe not altogether predictable journey, but the interesting thing, I guess, is that I, in some ways, ended up back where I started, but having learned a lot more, and I hope, you know, sharpened my understanding over the course of that journey.
Well, and I heard, or at least I read somewhere, that in junior high, you were interested in constitutions, and you wrote this constitution called the United American Empire, headed by you as the emperor. If you ever take another turn and you end up being emperor, can I be the chief executive propagandist, or maybe you're a fool or something like that?
It sounds like a marvelous arrangement. I'll keep you posted if a position as emperor comes my way. Let's talk more.
Absolutely. Well, and I have gone through my own journeys, and it's mostly been from the right, but I've been searching because the faith I was raised in, Roman Catholicism, I've learned a lot from it, I respect it, but it didn't speak to me, and I've come across Epicurus, and I think this has something to do with your history. It's one quote from Epicurus saying, "Friendship dances around the world, bidding us all to awaken to the recognition of happiness." You had a turn, I believe, when you were at Cambridge where you started to study friendship. What road did that lead you down?
Yeah, so my PhD dissertation looks at the idea and the experience of friendship. And I haven't written that much about the topic since. There's a book that really should have emerged from the dissertation that never has. But, you know, I'm more than not an extrovert. I'm somebody who really does draw energy from human interaction. And again, beginning in early adolescence, I started to make some deep, rich friendships that really mattered a lot to me. And, you know, it was, I think, part of the process of becoming my own person, differentiating myself from my family of origin. I hope not in a, you know, not in a hostile way, but just as a matter of defining myself as a unique individual. Forming those friendships really helped to shape who I was in some you know, some awesome ways. And there are people I you know, became close to when I was 14, 15, 16, who were, you know, were still really important in my life. And so, because of how significant friendship had been to me, and in particular, I guess, because of how significant one particular group of friends had been for me, it really seemed like a natural thing to explore, you know, a bunch of issues related to friendship. You know, the dissertation jumps around a bit. I mean, it looks at friendship and it's kind of the nature of friendship. It looks at friendship and spirituality. It looks at friendship and politics. It looks at friendship and ethics. And it draws on, you know, resources both from philosophy and from religion, as well as some stuff in social science. And, you know, it was really a delightful opportunity to spend, you know, the core of my graduate school time thinking about an experience that was hugely important for me. And, you know, I guess that's continued to be significant probably in more than one way, not only because I care about friendship and I'm glad to have thought about it, but because I've continued to write about personal relationships. You know, one of my recent books is a book about marriage, about love and marriage and the law. I've certainly, you know, I've written articles that that are germane there. My first book actually was a book in religion that tried to ask whether you know, love could really serve as the organizing principle for you know, for an understanding of religious belief. So yeah, a lot of things that I picked up in that the course of that early work on friendship, you know, really really continues to be important to me. And just as my friends are important. Another thing that mattered, actually, that was relevant early on, was I tried to think about a politics that would take friendship seriously. So you might know that Aristotle, among others, thought of friendship as the foundation of the political order of the Greek city-state. It's easy enough to see that when you've got a pretty small group of political actors, because of course only free adult males in that environment are going to be in a position to play political roles. Under those circumstances, a group of friends obviously could really be quite important. We live in a pretty different world, but I ask the question, if you really wanted to continue thinking of friendship as important for political life, what kind of politics would you need? And I was not in an anarchist mode at that point precisely, but I definitely saw that radical decentralization was needed if you wanted to sort of recapture that that early sense of friendship is politically important. So, I think all that work continues to resonate.
Well, and I'm at that point of radical decentralization. Depending on the day, I become anarchic. I asked the question because, as I got into libertarianism and just being a young sophomore guy, the young know everything, obviously. I used to, really get into heated fights on air and on social media, and for me it was all about winning the argument, which can be important, and arguments are wonderful, but, my dear mother, she passed 2 years ago, and I had to do, it was really a lot of soul-searching, and it made everything else, obviously, when you're in that type of melancholy, seem so unimportant, all the daily tit-for-tat with the political news. And then I started thinking about politics in that way, that the personal for me overthrew political consideration. It was more about trying to understand people, foster love, and understand where people are coming from with their motivations, rather than trying to win an argument. And so much of what your goal is, and I would like you to speak to this, when you advocate, and it seems to have run when you were, say, a social democrat and now as a market, left market anarchist, what is your main motivation in regards to other people?
There's so much to say that rotates around there. Let me begin by picking up on something you said a couple of minutes ago. And that's, just to think about the nature of political argument and what people want to accomplish with that. One of my real burdens over the past several years, I guess I really haven't written in depth about this, but it really is something that's hugely important to me, is thinking about the value of a social order in which there can be a tremendous amount of experimentation and individuality can find expression in all sorts of different ways, and in which real connection is possible despite that difference that's an integral part of individuality. That is, I think we're hardwired for connection. At any rate, I am, and I think many, many other people are, and we clearly all benefit from it in various ways. And yet, I think sometimes there's this perception that difference impedes connection, and we want to, obliterate difference on the part of the people we're trying to connect with, and I think that can be one of the motives that's involved in seeking to win an argument. And I think you see this especially in ideologically defined groups. And that can be the libertarian movement. It can be, the communist movement. It can be, hard shell Southern Baptists. There are a lot of different groups that are ideologically defined. But what we find, whatever the superficial definition that a group offers, is how frequently those within the group end up fighting with and excluding others who are actually really close to them on the basis of ideological differences that really become, in their perception, mammoth. When I was a graduate student at Cambridge, I happened to read about the Lord Chancellor of England, Laird Mackay of Clashfern. He was a Scottish mathematician and lawyer who had assumed under Margaret Thatcher the position of Lord Chancellor, which back then, at any rate, was the position of the person who kind of oversaw the legal system, was the kind of the judge in who was a manager of the British legal system. And Lev Mackay was an elder in a tiny little Scottish religious group. And so I have to back up. Back in the 19th century, this is a long story, but it's a crisp way of making a point. So okay. bear with me, if you will. Back in the 19th century, there was the established church in Scotland, the Church of Scotland. And there were a number of folks who thought that being tied up with the state was really really a bad thing. They didn't want to be subject to the rule of the state. They wanted to have an independent church. And so they created one. It was called the Free Church of Scotland. But then the Free Church of Scotland underwent a schism because there were people in that group who thought that it was much too liberal. They were hardcore conservative Calvinists. And so they split to form a group that came to be called the We Frees. Not just the Frees, but the We Frees. Hmm. Then there were folks who thought that the We Frees were much too liberal, and they split from the We Frees to form a group that is at least popularly referred to, and I'm not making this up, as the We Frees. So Lev Mackay of Clashbaron was an elder in the We Frees. And at some point, this would have been 88, fall of 88, he was disciplined by the We Frees because he had, wait for it, attended the funeral of a Catholic colleague in a Catholic church. And this was such a devastatingly bad thing that he was suspended from his role as an elder. I think he ultimately ended up leaving the We Frees and just joining the Church of Scotland. But the striking thing for me about this was how, you know, there was just this tendency to split and split and split in search of increasing ideological purity, even if that meant, in practical terms, just rejecting more and more people and creating alienated relationships with more and more people. And I think we see this when all of the different communist parties split, and I think we sometimes see it in the infighting among libertarians. So when I think about what I want is a society in which there is, you know, as I say, there's all this individuality, there's room for tremendous experimentation on the part of individuals and small groups. And at the same time, we find ways to welcome into friendship people, you know, who may well, you know, may well see the world very differently. We don't need to be threatened by that. We don't need to feel that our integrity or our beliefs are somehow called into question because somebody else differs with us. Because we're not threatened, we won't respond in hostile and defensive and aggressive ways. I notice this over and over again. And, you know, when you talk about the importance of love, I resonate immediately with that. And I say, you know, what I want is a world in which that's the norm and in which we can get along, you know, not in spite of our differences, but indeed welcoming each other without kind of making those differences barriers and indeed finding ways to learn from and celebrate what's going on in the social world around us rather than just retreating in fear.
Well, and I find that the schisms, and I don't, you know, there's always this hand-wringing in the libertarian, the liberty movement that, you know, we're so, you know, sectarian. We have all these schisms ourselves, but you see it happening right now in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party.
Absolutely.
It happens everywhere, and you talking about all these schisms reminds me of a phrase Christopher Hitchens used to use, that we are the pure and chosen few, and all the rest are damned. There's room enough in hell for you. We don't want heaven crammed. And, like, how small is heaven going to be? and it just, doesn't seem like the right way to go. I'd rather be a fool who loves than a wise man who hates everybody. And it moves me to what I was talking to folks about last night. I was trying to introduce them slowly, maturely, to the ideas of Deirdre McCloskey and how she uses the phrase, capitalism made us rich and wealthy beyond anybody's wildest dreams, not even the original liberals, but it also made us good people, or it tends to allow us to foster virtues. But then now I'm sitting here holding in my hands, and actually the guy you edited this book with, Charles Johnson, gave it to me. I met Charles at a dinner with Jeffrey Tucker, and I went, wait, you're that Charles Johnson? And he is such a wonderful guy, but the book is Markets, Not Capitalism, and I encourage everybody to pick it up, especially if you are listening right now and you are of, say, a left-wing persuasion, you voted for Hillary Clinton, you're a Democrat. I hope that you pick up this book. It has so many wonderful essays from you, Gary, from Charles, from Sheldon Richmond, from Kevin Carson, from so many people. But you have one point in this of why do we need to call it freed markets as opposed to capitalism?
So, you know, this is not a hill I'm here to die on.
Sure.
Let's be really clear about that.
Sure.
I think that there are people for whom this is really somehow the central question. And I think when they pick up that book or they engage with some of us at the Center for Stateless Society, they have the sense that, you know, this is really what we're on about, is getting people to change their words. And they think, oh, no, not another instance of the language police. And, that's not the point for me. And I have tremendous respect for Deirdre's work. And I totally get that, you know, it comes naturally to her to use capitalism there. And I'm just not here to lose sleep over that. But I can tell you why I care about this.
Okay.
I think that the language of capitalism outside the context of, you know, of work by classical liberal and libertarian economists, I think the word capitalism very frequently means, first of all, of course, as Roderick Long has pointed out, something muddled. It often gets used by the media and indeed by some other commentators, even academic commentators, to mean something like the free market system we have now. When, of course, what we have now is a system that is riddled with state-secured privilege that's been misshaped by past acts of violence and expropriation. And it just doesn't, in fact, represent what a genuinely liberated market order would look like. And so I think we can absolutely say with Deirdre and with, you know, a number of other people who've been writing about the, you know, the so-called Great Transformation, we can say, look, markets did an amazing job for an immense number of people, and let's not deny that, but let's also recognize that things could have been better, and things could have been excitingly different in a variety of ways without some of these distortions. When people who, say, might be inclined to, you know, vote for Bernie Sanders or for Jill Stein, people who relish, you know, the latest Michael Moore film, people who are not, that is to say, just kind of establishment corporatist Democrats,
right,
but see themselves as critics of the status quo on the left, when those people, you know, march in the streets or, you know, send tweets or whatever they do, I think very often their instinctive assumption, because of this rhetoric of capitalism is the free market system we have now, their assumption is very frequently, I think, to look at things they don't like in the society and say, these things are the fault of markets.
Hmm.
Now, and what I worry about is that that's ultimately a calumny. It's a libel on markets, which do such amazing things for people, you know, throughout the society. When bad things happen in a society that is defined by the presence of market institutions, it becomes really easy for people to blame those market institutions when, in fact, other things very often are at root the problem. And so I want us to use language of markets, of free markets, of, to use William Gillis's fetching phrase, freed, that is, liberated markets. Let's use that language if we can, so that it's very clear that we're not simply on board with the sort of boosterism that embraces the status quo in our society. We can absolutely acknowledge with people like Deirdre, with people like Angus Deaton, how much, the distorted and misshaped markets that have operated over the past 200 to 300 years have improved people's lives. I don't want to deny that. I don't want to underplay that at all. But I think by avoiding kind of mindless capitalism cheering, we give ourselves more freedom to look in radically critical ways at institutions in our society that are unjust and that, in fact, distort markets.
Well, and first off, I think Deirdre says in her introduction to her her apology that she's using capitalism in a wishy-washy way, and I really like what you're saying, because I get so frustrated with some of my conservative friends. For instance, Republicans came out today and said we're doing, you know, free market reforms. Oh, great. You're now block granting Medicaid to the states instead of having it be a federal government reimbursement. And you call that a free market reform. They constantly are using the language of liberty and free markets, where there are so many ties and privileges to big business, that they're not really living up to what I think we mean when we're trying to talk about free markets, or thus we want to have the markets freed. We want them liberated. And it's frustrating that there is so much of a language game here. There's a strategic game. But yeah, this is a big part of having these discussions. And we have to hit a quick break here, Gary. Our guest tonight, folks, is Gary Chartier. You're listening to the Joey Clark Radio Hour. And as I do every show, I bring you some music that I actually listened to this morning on my vinyl record player. But this one's a little weird because it was a happy accident of, let's say, online commerce. I'm a huge Prince fan, and all I wanted was his debut album For You on vinyl to listen to. But I get to the door, the mailman's come, there's the package on the outside. It says For You by Prince. And I open it up, and it's the greatest hits of My Chemical Romance. And there is one song, though, on that greatest hits of My Chemical Romance. I was playing it on my record player today, called Welcome to the Black Parade. It's a fantastic song, reminds me of high school. Folks, stay tuned. Again, my guest is Gary Chartier. We'll be right back.
When I was a young boy, my father took me into the city to see a marching band. He said, son, when you grow up, would you be the savior of the broken, the beaten, and the damned? He said, will you defeat them, your demons, and all the non-believers, the plans that they have made? Because one day I'll leave you a phantom to lead you in the summer to join the Black Parade.
Joey Clark.
The River Region's 24-hour news talk station. News Talk 93.1 FM WACV.
Hello, everyone. Robbie Pelt with Capital City Roofing. If you think about it, your home is your biggest investment in life. Your roof covers your home, so why jeopardize your biggest investment on a roofer you don't know anything about when you can deal with a reputable roofing company like Capital City Roofing? We have an A-plus Better Business rating and the best manufacturers and workmanship warranties available. We do all residential and commercial roofing applications that are certified through the manufacturer to ensure you get the best material and workmanship money can buy. We also have your project in our best interest before and after construction has been done. Don't hesitate to call us if you have any roofing issues or questions. We will match any of our competitors' price and give you the same great workmanship warranty. We also give free estimates. Give us a call today and let us show you the difference. 277-3311. That's 277-3311. Or you can check us out on the web at www.capitalcityroofing.com. Capital City Roofing. We capitalize the roofing industry.
No other vehicle quite matches the Mercedes-Benz C-Class, so let's compare it to a cheetah. The cheetah's sleek body is the essence of speed and efficiency. The seductive silhouette and sleek curves of the C-Class sedan match it line for line. The cheetah uses its tail to maneuver with ease. The C-Class's dynamic select changes the sedan's driving characteristics with the simple flip of a switch. The cheetah can turn in midair while sprinting. We're working on it. There's never been a better time to bring out the beast in you. Experience the 2018 C300 Sports Sedan, starting at just $40,250. Test drive one today. Mercedes-Benz, the best or nothing.
MSRP for a 2018 C300 Sports Sedan excludes all options, taxes, title, registration, transportation charge, and dealer prep. Options, month availability, and actual dealer price may vary. See dealer for details.
Visit Jack Inger Motors on the Eastern Boulevard for exceptional offers on a Mercedes-Benz.
Hey, folks, Dave Ramsey here. If you're looking for a great dentist, I want you to know that I trust SmileMakers. The doctors over at SmileMakers continue to raise the bar when it comes to dentistry. People are coming from all over to get a same-day smile. You heard me. You can get a complete smile makeover in one day. Whether it's the result of bad genetics, a bad decision, or just some bad luck, missing teeth can keep you from enjoying the life you deserve. At SmileMakers, you have options. Not only do they perform same-day smiles, but they also offer life-changing dental implants. When you're in need of complex dental work, I recommend the doctors at SmileMakers in Montgomery. Folks, experience and technology matter. Give SmileMakers a call today for a free consultation or a second opinion. 334-269-8086. That's 334-269-8086. Online at SmileMakersAL.com. And tell them Dave sent you.
Hey, this is Willie Robertson. As CEO of Duck Commander, I'm a busy guy. Only Dixie Chopper mowers get the job done fast, so I can get back to doing what I love best, hunting. For over 30 years, Dixie Chopper has built a legacy of manufacturing the fastest and toughest zero-turn mowers. No other mower has the speed, power, and performance of a Dixie Chopper. Take command of your lawn with Dixie Chopper, the world's fastest lawnmower.
See the complete line of Dixie Choppers at Farmers Feed Service, U.S. Highway 231 in Wetumpka. Farmers Feed Service, an authorized Dixie Chopper dealer. The Rich Thomas Weather Network, brought to you by Capital City Ace Hardware. When it comes to hardware for your home, Ace is the place. 3215 Taylor Road next to Applebee's.
Ace is a place with the helpful hardware, folks. Rich Thomas Weather.
Pretty routine summer evening forecast, even though it's getting late in the ball game. Could be an isolated thunderstorm somewhere in the area. Otherwise, it'll fade out after dark. Overnight low 71. Kind of humid tonight. Tomorrow, rain chances get a little bit better. Not just tomorrow, but Thursday, too. Scattered showers and thunderstorms. About 40% coverage both days. Highs in the upper 80s to around 90. Lows at night around 70. And decent chance for scattered showers and storms Friday as fall begins with a high around 89. From the National Weather Association Conference in Los Angeles, for Blue Water Broadcasting, this is Rich Thomas.
This is Brian Carr of Benjamin Moore Paint, New Look Decorating. When it's time to make it new again, it's New Look, where we make it simple, you make it beautiful. Benjamin Moore Paint, New Look Decorating, 6237 Atlanta Highway.
The premier place the River Region turns to for news, weather, traffic, and opinion. News Talk 93.1 FM, WACV.
Your demons.
Joey Clark.
Now, welcome back to the program. You are listening to the Joey Clark Radio Hour. My guest this evening is Gary Chartier. He is the author of a book called Conscience of an Anarchist. He edited a book I'm sitting here holding, looking at right now, Markets Not Capitalism. He's written several other books. He is an associate dean, I believe, at the Law School and Business Ethics School at La Sierra University out in California. And Gary, to continue our conversation, I want to focus on your book, Conscience of an Anarchist. And by quoting words that I think most Americans know, though sometimes we give our fellow Americans too much credit, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." So I ask you, Gary, are we actually a nation based on consent of the governed?
So I think we're not. And the interesting thing is that I think that's widely recognized. I don't have the conscience of an anarchist in front of me, but I remember that when I wrote that portion of the book, I cited a poll which noted the fact that some very substantial portion of the American public did not believe that the government as then constituted enjoyed the consent of the governed. And the reality is, if you ask whether you or I or most of our listeners did anything that actually conveyed genuine assent to the authority of the United States government or of any other governmental institution, I think the answer is almost certainly going to be no. The reality is that people who arrive as immigrants are asked to swear oaths supporting the Constitution and so forth. But for those of us who were born here, or those of us who arrive in other ways, rather than through the kind of formal immigration process, there simply isn't any kind of assent. And of course, even when you do formally assent, as Charles Johnson points out in a very powerful essay that I refer to, I believe, in The Conscience of an Anarchist, if you consent with a gun pointed at your head, there's really not much reason to treat that that seriously as consent, even when it does occur. But in most cases, it doesn't. There's no consent at all. The fact is, we arrive in the middle of a social system that's already ongoing. There are people claiming to exercise legitimate authority. There are people who definitely wield pretty massive force that they can use to make us obey them. And a lot of us go along, and a lot of us, may just pragmatically welcome, relative orderliness of the society. But I don't think it would occur to people, in the absence of what I would call ideological mystification, to imagine that there was any kind of genuine consensual basis for the authority that's exercised over us. I think what happens in the history of Western societies that you have people like Hobbes and Locke who formulate the idea that there's a kind of social contract that serves as the basis for governmental authority, really as a way of providing a new source of legitimacy for the state, right? So, traditionally, in the centuries immediately before that, state authority had seemed to be based on the divine right of kings, and it just became harder and harder and harder to imagine, including for very devout religious people, that God somehow had entitled this or that person just because of how, he or she happened to have arrived in the world with the authority to govern other people's lives. It just seemed more and more absurd. And when you saw really bad behavior on the part of kings, even more absurd. And then, of course, in England, you had people rise up and actually execute a king for bad behavior. And so the divine right of kings just was exerting less and less of a hold on people's imaginations. And so you have somebody like Hobbes, who's terrified by the threat of just chaos and social violence. And so Hobbes basically says, look, we need to submit to the absolute authority of somebody, whether it's the king or a parliament. In his book Leviathan, he's open to the possibility that the Leviathan he envisions could be any number of different kinds of institutions. But we need to submit to somebody's absolute authority so that we won't kill each other and we can all just have a peaceful society. And so he kind of frames this in terms of a social contract, but it seems pretty clear that the basic argument is not rooted in the view that, some people in some unimaginable distant past actually got together and agreed to give over their authority to the monarch. Rather, the thought is that would be the rational thing to do. And so there, if it were the rational thing for them to do, it would be the rational thing for us to do. I mean, that's really, I think, the force of what Hobbes is up to. It's a little less clear in Locke's case. Locke does maybe think that there actually was some kind of social contract in the past. I guess that's a matter of debate among people who study Locke. But anyway, the bottom line is the basic function of these views was to provide some kind of new justification for social order. So Locke, again, had seen this revolution happen. He understood that revolution was potentially legitimate, but he really wanted to cabin these energies that had kind of exploded into the open. He didn't want people, engaging in lots of revolutions. He wanted to to really see the grant and the withdrawal of consent as part of a pretty stable process of government maintenance. And, you know, it's clear that the American founders who used this language of the consent of the governed, weren't altogether consistent about it, right? I mean,
right.
Even if you thought that consent was exercised through the political process, we know that, there were slaves, there were women, there were, other people who lacked political enfranchisement. But, the rhetoric, though, became really powerful, even though it didn't accurately describe things, even within the terms of the political system they were embracing. People learn in their high school government classes that the consent of the governed is what justifies authority, and they just kind of repeat that and they kind of believe it without stopping to think about the fact that they themselves almost certainly never granted any consent.
I know that at the age of 28, as I am, I didn't consent for a lot of the legacy programs like Social Security, Medicare, or what I like to call American Empire and all the obligations abroad. And I mean, these are things I'm born into, and I pride myself on not having any personal debt. And then, April comes around and the government is taking out debt in my name. And it is very frustrating. 45%, I think, around that number didn't even vote in this past election. And I find that it is not consent-based, that you do not have consent when the government is demanding that consent. And folks, I think Gary just dropped off for a second, but now he is back. Gary, are you there?
I am, yeah.
That was almost seamless. I was filling time. I'm trying to get good at this. But I already just gave the game away that you dropped off, but I was saying that there are so many legacy programs, whether, domestic welfare or, imperial obligations abroad, even if well-intentioned, and that could be debated itself, that, at 28 years old, I'm born into this and I'm supposedly consented to this. 45% of the population around there didn't vote. And it just, on the face of it, to me, seems absurd. And I've met a lot of people in my life, but I've never met the people. It's almost like this rhetoric, this idealistic rhetoric, is people are taking it too literally.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it's easy to get snookered because you hear it in your high school government class. Well, that's the foundation of our democracy. It's the consent of the governed. And so this just gets repeated, and people are, in effect, just sort of intellectually bullied into accepting that as the premise for their participation in societal life. And then, if that, that high school government teacher gets asked, so when exactly did we consent? If that's what matters, what's the response going to be? Well, I don't know, by remaining here, you consent. But, clearly that can't be right.
Right.
I mean, I go about living my life, and because I choose not to, sell my house and leave and, vanish into the Pacific, therefore I'm somehow consenting. I mean, I think that's pretty ridiculous. But people don't stop really to think about what this means. The interesting thing, however, for whatever it's worth, and I don't want to put more weight on this than it deserves, but when kind of serious political theorists think about this, I think there's more and more of a consensus that actual consent is absent. And so, I think among political philosophers who think about the justification for state authority, it's really become, I think, quite acceptable to be a, quote, philosophical anarchist. Now, what that ends up meaning is not necessarily that you have any belief in the merits of a genuinely stateless society, but it does mean that you think that the state lacks the ability to issue commands to people that, as a matter of course, they're obligated to obey. And there may be reasons that are... So then people who take this view will go on to say, but there may be all sorts of pragmatic reasons why we should go along. They're, much more kind of Hobbesian reasons. They're not Lockean reasons. The, kind of full-blown consent, the transfer of rights to some authority from me, you know, to this authority. That's just not a view that I think most people doing this kind of stuff in political philosophy think about. Rather, they've got the view that, you know, Hobbes is probably right, that we probably don't want to kill each other, and maybe we need a central authority to do that. Consent-based justifications are not available. I mean, I'm not saying there's nobody who thinks they are. Clearly, some people do, but I think it's much more common these days.
Well, and that makes me think of why I included in my introduction a line from H.L. Mencken, is that in politics, man must learn to rise above principle. And I remember I had a progressive polka dot sock feminist teacher who wrote up on the board one day, democracy. And she asked the class, what does this mean? Nobody would raise her hand. I raised my hand because I was already doing a radio show, even when I was not a good student, Gary, unless I was really interested in the class. And so, but I raised my hand, and I think I said something like, democracy is the theory of government. The common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard. She didn't think it was funny. But it is, I think, in my mind, I look at it now, and it's almost like my idealism as I was raised an American has fallen away. And I've become, and I have been, very cynical, but I'm trying to think of positive solutions. And you offer all sorts of options in your book, Conscience of an Anarchist. Are there historical examples, loose historical examples? Are there some potential ways we could, say, address problems like helping the poor and maybe, you know, defending against people who are just violent folks?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that, just to carry on from where we were a moment ago with this talk about consent, I mean, the reality is that people often imagine that social order really depends on Leviathan, that we can't defend ourselves, that we can't, you know, take care of each other in various ways without some central authority. But the reality is, if we were actually intent in general on resisting that central authority, central authority obviously couldn't fly, right? The reality is, it's our perception, and by our, I don't mean yours and mine, but just, you know, people in general, the perception that that central authority is legitimate and therefore we should go along with it, that enables it to continue doing what it does. So if you had a genuinely consensual social order, a free social order that people understood to be legitimate in the same way, I think we could expect them to go along with that and to take seriously the you know, the legal institutions and the social norms in that kind of order. I don't think there's anything magical about cooperating with the state, when the reality is the state most of the time isn't making people do anything. There's always the threat that it can do that, right? But people's kind of acquiescence really is important, and that acquiescence is driven by a perception of legitimacy. So if we think about history, I don't want to pretend that there are just perfect examples anywhere of the kind of society that you or I would want. Again, people had different ideologies, they emerged from different circumstances, and you know, undoubtedly societies that are sometimes pointed to as examples here aren't perfect ones, but it is certainly still the case that we can talk about big picture and large large scale examples, and also some smaller scale examples that are relevant. So in terms of just this maintaining social order with certainly very limited social authority, political authority, state authority, that you can think about examples provided by, by ancient Iceland, which has been worked through in great detail by people like David Friedman, Ireland, before about the 9th century. Similarly, one example that it's always kind of fun to toss out because it upsets people is Ethiopia. Hmm. Because people often think about Ethiopia as a really just a crazy example, but we wouldn't want that. Isn't that just the domain of crazy warlords? But the reality is that
outside the Capitol, order has largely been maintained by you know, these consensual institutions, the Islamic courts. Are they perfect? No. Do you and I necessarily want to embrace the particular legal order that they would endorse? Not necessarily. But the reality is that they're not territorial monopolists, and they've managed to maintain order. All of the crazy kind of Ethiopia stories that people often repeat are stories that have to do with the you know, kind of the crazy violence in and around the Capitol, right. And that's just not the same thing as what's going on you know, what's going on in the countryside. You know, Pete Leeson, in a wonderful book that you and some of your readers might know, called The Invisible Hook, talks about the way in which pirates in the golden age of piracy, who obviously had no state authority to manage their lives, nonetheless found ways to create kind of robust and sustainable legal systems that they lived under, and you know, they had constitutions and they actually adhered to them because it made sense for them to do so. You know, it was a matter of sheer practicality. You know, in terms of taking care of the economically vulnerable, I mean, one thing that I think would make a lot of sense to talk about is the history of mutual aid in you know, both England and the United States. Famously, there's a really substantial record, say, in the 19th century, of the friendly societies, the mutual aid societies, providing very inexpensive health care and you know, unemployment you know, coverage and retirement, funeral assistance, and so forth for their members. I know we're running out of time, but so I just want to alert people to a wonderful article they can find online by my friend Roderick Long called "How Government Solved the Healthcare Crisis."
Yes.
And the healthcare crisis with which he's concerned here is the crisis of care costing too little to keep up the monopoly profits that the healthcare providers wanted. Check that out. Bottom line, I think there's some really interesting stuff out there.
Well, and folks, Roderick's not too far from us. I think he's still over there at Auburn. I've had the pleasure of meeting him. And Gary, I really appreciate you being on the show tonight. I wish we did have more time to go into things. This discussion could lead all many roads. But thank you for being my guest tonight. Folks, again, it has been Gary Chartier. Check out his book, Conscience of an Anarchist. Check out the book he helped edit, Markets, Not Capitalism, and generally what he is doing. Gary, thanks again.
A real pleasure to be here.
Well, folks, that'll do it for us tonight. You've been listening to the Joey Clark Radio Hour. Have a good evening, and tune in tomorrow for my guest, Jeffrey Tucker, on his new book, Right-Wing Collectivism, The Other Threat to Liberty.
Joey Clark.